If you were with us last week, we looked at the first five verses of 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we talked about human sexuality as coming underneath the lordship of Jesus. Since God created all things and created human beings, male and female, all topics come underneath the lordship of Jesus. And so we talked about last week how the human body was created not mainly for pleasure, but for God's purposes and for God's glory. This week, we're going to try to answer the question, what does sexuality look like for the married couple? What's God's plan and God's design for the married couple? Or how should couples think about intimacy within the covenant of marriage? That's the topic for today, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. That's why we're talking about this. If you've never asked that question, I just asked it for you and beat you to the punch. We do know that our society and the culture has no problem talking about sex, portraying sex in all kinds of different ways. As a church, we want to make sure that we talk about these things as well. Why? Because this is God's world. It's God's creation. And part of the effects or the curse of the fall is to think of subjects and topics like sex apart from the creator of it, to not think about God in terms of this. And if the devil can get us to kind of push God to the margins of our minds, then what he can do is he can kind of wiggle his slimy little self into our life and into the way we think and urge us to do whatever feels right. This is what Satan did in the garden. Comes to Adam and Eve and says, "Did God really say that?" You know, pushing God out of the conversation, leave God way over there. This is what Satan does. He does it all the time. I think the topic of sexuality is really a case in point. So for the Christian, though, anytime sex is brought up, the next thought should be God, since he made it and he created it. So sex is not in competition with God. It is underneath the lordship of God. It's a created thing within the realm of his good, in fact, beautiful creation. So we want to give him the credit for it and not the devil for it. It's not the devil's idea. The devil has never had a good idea. All of his ideas are bad. And pleasure and enjoyment, all the good things in the world come from God. So we want to bring God into it. I really want to try to do this morning what I think Christians, in my experience, often fail to do. Here's what we're going to do if you see the screen. We're going to bring the topic of sex out of the shadows, where it can be, underneath the beautiful, burning, bright light of the Lord Jesus, like every other topic. So these five verses here in 1 Corinthians 7, they're not a full explanation of marriage. So if you look at the whole teaching about marriage, you go to Ephesians 5, and in Ephesians 5, Paul talks about the meaning and purpose of marriage as basically a little window into Jesus' relationship with us, the church. And that's another view of marriage, another kind of broader view of marriage. That's not really what Paul is talking about here. Instead, what he's really talking about is a specific facet of marriage, mainly how sexuality should be expressed between a husband and a wife. What's God's plan for that? It's practical. It's to the point, and Paul gets right to it. So here we go. We're going to get right to it as well. What was going on here with this church? The members of the church in Corinth had really had all of this life before they knew Jesus, and they had been shaped by their families, their culture, their society. And so their brains had really been formed already in a lot of ways and jam-packed with a lot of wrong ideas about a lot of things. And so if you think of this church as a garden, there were a lot of weeds in it to pull. And if you're a gardener, you know you got to pull weeds out before you just start planting new things in the garden. The soil can only take so much. And so this church had so many weeds in it that Paul had to go in and just root out and pull out. And these were former ways of thinking. And this is a normal process. And they were in need of a kind of a cleansing experience, a sanctifying experience, in the process of becoming more like Jesus. So when they were saved, they were brought into this new reality. I think actual reality, the way the world actually is. They were brought out of this old way of thinking into this new way of thinking, and that took time, and that was a process. That's really what the church is, by the way. The church is here to help us think accurately about the world and about ourselves. Or the church is here to form the way we think, not necessarily confirm how you have always thought. Or it's here to teach you something new, not simply affirm what you already know. And so in other words, when you step into this gathering, or wherever we're going to gather, it's going to have an effect on you. It's going to shape you. It's going to form you. That's part of what the church is meant to do. That's what the Bible does. It teaches us and shapes us. And this is what is going to happen here in the church in Corinth. Now, thankfully, this church really wore its heart on its sleeve. It had a lot of issues, but at least they said what they were. And they weren't afraid to say, here's where we are. This is what you have to deal with, Paul. Here are our sort of warts and all. They were not ones to run from a fight. And this is what change will involve. Change will involve just honesty, like this is where I'm at. And it is a bit of a wrestling match between our old ways of thinking, our own pattern of thinking, and God's way of thinking. Spiritual growth is really, I think, mainly stunted when we're unwilling to be honest with where we're at. Just being honest. To ignore the weeds. To say, I don't got any weeds. I don't got anything that needs to be pulled out. But that's going to stunt our growth. If we're honest, growth always follows. God really does incredible work as we step into relationship with Him honestly. This church was immature, but thankfully, they really weren't afraid to show it. You know, it's like going to the gym. You know, it's like, here I am. I'm going to the gym. I don't have anything to prove. I'm just going to go to the gym and work out. It's like, I am who I am. That's kind of what the church in Corinth was doing. They wanted to step into this. I think they had at least a number of people in the church who really did want to take this on and be shaped, and they were willing to be honest about it. And Paul was definitely willing to take them on exactly where they were. So circulating in this church were really two wrong views of human sexuality. The first is we looked at last week. We have it on YouTube in a podcast thing. If you want to go check it out, feel free. But the first wrong thing we looked at last week, and some members thought of sex as little more than an animal instinct to be given full reign over the body. So a modern euphemism that you've probably heard is, if it feels good, do it. And that's actually a pretty common way of thinking. The other wrong view was to see sexual expression as bad and dirty and less than God's ideal for His people. So there was a slogan circulating in the church as well, and it went something like this: it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. So this view basically states that abstinence is the best way, even within marriage, and it's better to be abstinent than have sexual expression even within marriage. In other words, sex is undignified. It's beneath the plan of God. It's beneath those who are truly spiritual. So both of these are extreme ways of thinking. Sex is little more than a bodily impulse that has no real meaning, or sex is casual. Or, on the other side, sex is a dirty thing and beneath people. And it should be avoided in the pursuit of something higher and more spiritual. So which one's right? Which extreme is right? Well, I think they were both a little right about a couple little things, but they were both mostly wrong about the whole thing. So there's a sliver of truth in almost everything we see and hear. There's a reason 2 out of every 3 shows on television have some kind of sexual content in it, which is probably very true. Why is that? Because sex is good. It's a good thing. It's intriguing. It's compelling. But it's not good when it's used in the wrong context or used in the wrong way. And so what Paul is going to do here is he's just going to say, okay, these are the two extreme views of thinking. I'm going to take these and I'm going to kind of parse out what is right about what you're thinking and what is wrong about what you're thinking. I'm going to affirm some of what you're saying. I'm going to disaffirm or pull out or remove other ways that you are thinking. So let's get into it a little bit. He says in verse 2, we're not into it yet. We're just getting into it, by the way. Here we go. We're wading out into the deep. Here we go. It says this: because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. So here's the best of both worlds. Yes, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman outside of marriage, but it's also good for a man to have sexual relations with his own wife within the covenant of marriage. This is what Paul's teaching. So sex should be fun, free, expressive, playful even, casual, within a lifelong covenant of marriage between a man and a woman. But sex should not be explored outside of that covenant. And so if you think of it, it's like a dam. Like the dam that holds back sexual passion should be built up before marriage, but taken down after marriage. So long as that sexual passion is expressed toward one's spouse in a consensual way, in a self-giving way, not in a demanding way, but in a loving way. So what's Paul doing here? He's calling for, I think, free, guiltless, shameless sexual intimacy within marriage and the cutting off of sexual expression outside of marriage. This is a, you know, if you've been in a church at all, you've probably heard this before. This is just sexual ethics. This is what Paul's teaching about how the marriage relationship should work. So he goes on, though, a little bit further. He doesn't leave it at that. He goes a little bit deeper here. In verse 3, he says this: the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. Now, the term conjugal rights is not the most romantic, sexy phrase you'll see, okay? But it's actually a pretty incredible statement that he's making here. You know, most newlyweds are not, really thrilled on their wedding night that now they get to give each other conjugal rights. It just doesn't have that sound to it. It's a joke, by the way. I'm trying to lighten the mood a little bit here. But the phrase is actually pretty profound and pretty awesome, what Paul's getting at. Because it takes on new meaning 10 years after the wedding, or 15 years after the wedding, and 2 or 3 kids later, and 5 kids later. And sex becomes less convenient and less easy to carve out time for. And so when the man comes home from work at 6 p.m., tired, or the wife comes home from work, ready to take a nap, and the man is ready for conjugal rights, but she isn't, what happens? Or when the husband is ready for, or flip them. If the wife's been home all day or the husband's been home all day and one of them wants to enjoy intimacy and the other one doesn't, what do you do? What happens? And those roles can be flipped all over the place. Now, before I answer that question, let me just make an important point. I think that the text is making itself, just so that we're clear about some things. It does not say the man should demand sex from his wife or the wife should demand sex from her husband. It doesn't say that. That's not how it reads. Instead, it says that both spouses should give each other what is owed to the other. In other words, sexual union should be mutual and never coerced, never demanded. It's not a taking, but a giving over. It's not meant to be done selfishly, but it's meant to be done selflessly. As Gordon Fee says here, Paul's emphasis is not on you owe me, but I owe you. And so the answer for the man or woman who is not, in the mood, so to speak, is to pray and pray for energy and pray for strategy and turn over the rights to your own body over to your spouse. In other words, live out the covenant. What happens at the covenant? What happens when a man and a woman get married, when they go up to the altar and they commit to each other? What happens? It's a giving over. It's saying, you owe me now. My body is your body. Your body is my body. And so how that is fulfilled, that's going to take strategy. That's going to take thought and prayer. But Paul's saying it's important that you think of this as a right of the other. Your body is not yours. It belongs to your spouse. Not out of duty, but out of love. Now, on a practical note here, physical exhaustion will keep couples from staying united, I think emotionally, I think relationally, I think sexually, physically. And so don't be afraid to take a nap every once in a while and sleep in when you can, or leave the lawn uncut for a few days. Just let some of the other things go for a little bit. Carve out time to rest. Carve out time to renew your covenant vow. It takes time. Relationships take time. Unlike the world says, sex is not automatic. It's not automatic. It takes thought. It takes planning. It takes intentionality. And I think we forget this because we live in a microwave world. At least we have a microwave. Maybe you don't. Some people don't. That's fine. But we live in a microwave world. It's a click and buy culture. It's if you want something, you can get it fast, get it quick. If you got a headache, gobble up 4 ibuprofen. Just be careful how, just stagger that, right? Or if you are low on AAA batteries, you just hop on Amazon and order them up, and in 3 hours, they show up at your door, and you got batteries. Or if you're craving a burger, there's a McDonald's within 10 minutes of it, of everywhere in the Twin Cities. Okay, we generally think if we want something, we'll get it quickly. But that's not how it works within a marriage. Sexual intimacy is not so easy to come by. It requires a lot of ingredients, including time, including listening, including connecting, including laughing and crying and learning about each other. And so it's a complex experience that requires the giving over of our whole self to the other. In other words, you get out of it what you put into it, like every other human relationship. You get out of it what you put into it. The same can be said for any relationship, for dads in the room. You know that if you want to connect with your kid, your child, your boy or your girl, you don't just throw a toy at them and say, go have fun. That's not really going to establish much of a relationship. You don't throw more money at your kids. You don't throw more opportunities at them. I mean, that's part of it. But you connect with them. You talk with them. You sit down with them and look at them and hear from their heart. And how are you doing? And what do you want me to know about what you're experiencing right now? You don't throw more toys at them. And when our boys were a little bit younger, they're still young enough, a couple of them, but you get down on the floor and you play on the floor. You get down on their level and you spend time with them. And healthy relationships really demand, I think, the costliest thing we have, which is our time. Man, our time and our energy. That's what healthy relationships demand. And that's certainly true in a marriage as well. You get out of it what you put into it. The basis for this giving over of oneself to each other in the context of marriage is in verse 4. Here's what it says. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So this really catapults sex to a whole other level of meaning, because a healthy intimate life within marriage is an authority issue. It's an authority issue. If a husband hoards his own body and his own time and withholds himself physically, emotionally, relationally, the marriage will suffer for it. If the wife hoards herself, hoards her own body, and uses her body as leverage on her husband, or withholds sex as a sort of punishment, which happens, the marriage will suffer for it as well. I think this verse is making it really, really clear. The sexual health of a marriage requires a letting go of your own body from head to toe to the other. It's remembering the covenant you made at the altar. I belong to you, you belong to me. That covenant's to be lived out every day, every moment. And when it's not being lived out, you go back to it. No, what was the covenant I made? This is what Paul is getting at. It's a letting go of all of yourself from head to toe to the one that you covenanted with. This includes, of course, an emotional letting go as well. If a couple is at loggerheads over some issue, and this doesn't happen within the couples in Future City, I know, but other families, joking. You're at loggerheads, you've hit kind of a point where you're disagreeing over money, over parenting, over whether or not to come to church service. I don't know. But there's a disagreement. And neither will give in. What happens is you're going to bring that disagreement right into the bed with you and into your intimate world as well. And so if an emotional or relational wall is built up, a physical intimacy wall is built up as well. Or if the husband or wife has built up a wall of secrecy regarding something, they're not being honest about things in their life. If there's a wall of guilt or shame, that wall will extend right on into the bedroom and into the intimate world as well for a married couple. And so intimacy is both sexual and emotional, and they're interwoven together. You can't have one without the other, I don't think. This is probably why newlyweds spend at least their first year or 5 years or 10 years trying to figure out this whole sex thing, because it's not simple. And what newlyweds don't know, and I've done pre-counseling for a variety of couples, and we went through pre-counseling as a couple 16 years ago, or more than 16 years ago, 18, 19, What I think they don't know, and what we don't think about and take for granted, is that good sex requires equally good communication. equally good communication or better communication. In other words, if you want to be naked physically, you got to be naked emotionally too. And that can be downright uncomfortable and slightly embarrassing. Now, this kind of thinking, by the way, is really unique to the Christian community. But I think we can go there. I think we can be kind of amazingly authentic with each other because of Jesus, because we've been forgiven. It makes us unique, I think, in the world. Because what you'll hear on television and on the internet, everywhere basically, is this. Respect yourself, look out for yourself, guard yourself, protect yourself, keep your cards close to your chest so that if you need to evacuate a relationship, you can do it easily without much pain. I mean, the world really encourages a sort of one foot in, one foot out policy, an exit strategy. Or I'm going to go this far in my honesty, but not any farther. And for the Christian community, it's just not like that. You're putting both feet in. And we don't put exit doors into marriage. We don't put an escape hatch. And well, I'll give you 80% of the honest truth, but the 20%, no, that's mine. No, the two shall become one. This involves honesty and authenticity. And the pattern that we follow in this is Jesus. Jesus has not put an exit door in his covenant with us. Has he? No. He's in it for the long haul. And Jesus, the reason he designed the covenant of marriage is in part, at least, so that we would have a window into the profound loyalty he has shown to us. Jesus made a covenant in his blood to love us forever. He made the covenant in the upper room before the disciples betrayed him, before he was hung up on a cross and had nails in his wrists and feet. Jesus has no escape plan. He was not halfway in with us and halfway out. He's all in with us. So marriage, human marriage, is to mirror that, or at least seek to mirror that. We're all in, 2 feet in. I'm staying. I'm here. I have no plan to leave. And Jesus is just so kind to unite his life to us, isn't he? I mean, just the condescension that Jesus had to do to unite with us and to be with us. It's one thing to be in a covenant with a fellow sinner, pouty, moody. I'm talking about myself, by the way. Downright difficult sometimes to live with. But can you imagine what it's like for Jesus, the perfect Son of God, to be covenanted with us? You know, he is our motivation to really hang in there, to stay in there when our human covenants get a bit difficult and hard to continue, and when it becomes more difficult than we ever thought. Does giving over authority to your spouse within this covenant of marriage really begins by giving authority over to Jesus, giving yourself to Jesus first within the eternal covenant that he has with us. And because we belong to Jesus, we can give ourselves to our spouse. We give ourselves to God first. God, I'm all in with you. And you want me to be all in with this person, then I'm all in with my spouse as well. But it begins by giving yourself to God. Like chapter 6, verse 9 says, you are not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. This glorifying of God with our bodies happens when we give our bodies over to each other and say, I am yours and you are mine. As Solomon said in his Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 16, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. Now this brings up an important, I think, caveat here that Paul, I think, is hinting at here. So with all this giving over talk and self-sacrifice talk, when is it appropriate to make a request for intimacy within marriage? Is it ever okay to initiate it within marriage? Or do both husband and wife just wait for the other to sort of get things going, so to speak? I think it's a good question because if we're not careful, we will get a bit carried away with what can be a phony sort of self-sacrifice and fake humility, guarding yourself, not being honest about yourself. And I don't think that's the way to go. Chapter 13 of this book is the love chapter, and we're going to get to that probably a few months from now. But we're going to learn that love does not seek its own interests, its own way. That is true, but there is an unhealthy form of self-suppression disguised as humility, and disguised as meekness when it really isn't. You need to be honest with your thoughts and your hopes and your desires is what I think Paul is getting at. This is, you know, like a husband and wife going out to eat and they can't decide where to eat, you know, and the husband says, you decide, and the wife says, no, you decide. Well, someone has to decide. Someone has to put it on the line. Oh, we're going to go to Culver's today, or we're going to go to whatever. Yeah, Culver sounds good to me. Concrete mixers, man, they're good. Someone got DoorDash on their app. Can we order that out? No, okay. But someone has to pick. Someone has to lead. Someone has to be honest and put themselves out there. And sometimes the most selfish decision that we can do is to fail to make a decision. I'm too meek. I'm too humble. You decide. That's not leadership, and that's not love. That's not what God does with us. So within marriage, you have to be honest about your desires, your thoughts. And someone has to initiate this, if not even for your own sake, for the sake of the other, and for the sake of the health of the marriage as a whole. This is what verse 5 is saying and says, do not deprive one another except for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come back together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This is one of several passages in the Bible that really make it clear. Sexual union is not an option. It's not like an optional expression. It's necessary. It's mandatory even. And so to be married and celibate is not a good combination. To be married and celibate is not a good combination. There are some cases like illness or injury or sickness or distance apart where it's not possible, but the general rule is that believing couples should be enjoying this intimacy on a regular basis as a built-in shield against temptation. So, when should a married couple intentionally abstain from intimacy in this way? Only for the purposes of prayer and not for too long. I mean, a three-month prayer sabbatical, I don't know, we'll see, but that's not what he's saying. He's saying for a limited time. Why? Because Satan might use that opportunity to drive a wedge in between the couple. That means, I think, that men, don't withhold your wants and your needs from your wife. Be honest, even if it's embarrassing. Don't withhold that. And wives, don't withhold your wants and your needs from your husband. By the way, that includes physical and emotional and relational. Put all your needs out in the open. And be one in every way. A relationship really requires more than giving. It always requires taking what now belongs to you. And when that is happening, when both are giving fully, both are then receiving fully. You see the dance. You see the dance that Paul, I think, is painting here in the picture he's painting. So we got to swallow our pride and be honest with each other. We really do. And by the way, if you being honest is like, oh, I was wrong, then you were wrong and you can deal with it. But again, going back to the beginning of this sermon, start with honesty, right? Honesty is always the way to start. It's always safe to be honest in a lot of ways. Humbly honest. This is built-in protection from the temptation to pursue any kind of sexual expression outside of your marriage covenant. Now, interestingly, verse 5 is only the second and now the last time Satan is mentioned in this letter to the church in Corinth. Both times, it's in the context of sex. Why is that? Because Satan is slimy, and because Satan loves to snoop around the good things of God and twist them and distort them and use them against God's people. So he wants us to think sex and then Satan the next thing we think about, or the world the next thing we think about. This is what the devil does. You could take that down there. This is what the devil does. He didn't create sex. He didn't create any good thing in the world that people enjoy. But he uses good things and twists them for his own purposes. So don't give him credit, I think, is what the Bible is teaching us, for anything good in the world, any pleasure in the world, even though they can be often distorted. It's not Satan's idea. It's God's idea. In C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, I'm wrapping up here, by the way, so just give me a couple more minutes. In C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, there's a senior devil named Screwtape, and he's teaching his understudy, Wormwood, how to lead Christians away from God. And this is what Screwtape is teaching his understudy. Here's what he says about God. By the way, God is considered an enemy because this is like a devil speaking. So I'm going to confuse you just for a minute, but hang in there. It says this: never forget that when we are dealing with any pleasure in its healthy and normal and satisfying form, we are in a sense on the enemy, which is God's ground. I know we have won many a soul through pleasure. All the same, it is his, God's, invention, not ours. He made the pleasure. All our research so far has not enabled us to produce one pleasure. I love that. All we can do is encourage the humans to take the pleasures which our enemy, God, has produced at times or in ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. So Satan's little scheme is to get us to look for pleasure outside of God's plan instead of within it. So for married couples, this union is the first line of defense against that scheme. We become each other's accountability partners. And how a couple is doing in this area of sexual temptation is determined by how well they are enjoying sexual union together. So in summary, sex is something to be avoided outside of marriage, yes. But for the married couple, sex is not to be avoided. It's to be pursued. There's a red light to sex outside of the covenant of marriage. There is a green light to pursue that intimacy within the lifelong grace-empowered covenant between two redeemed children of God. Now, here's the good news, I think, for all of us. None of us are going to get all this stuff figured out perfectly. Don't worry about that. Bring God into your marriage if you've not done that. Pray through this stuff. Embrace these things prayerfully. None of us are going to figure this stuff out perfectly. None of us have a perfect track record in every way. None of us have a perfect sex life in the same way that none of us have a perfect prayer life or thought life. We're all being perfected and changed. There's no perfect person on the planet except for one. His name is Jesus. He's the one. And with him leading us, we are able to become more like him. God promises single people and married people the perfecting work of his Spirit in us. That's really good news. So let's stay dependent on him. Let's keep on walking by the Spirit in every area of our lives. Please pray with me. God, thank you for this opportunity to be in the middle part of this letter, Lord. And I think this is really important teaching. I really do, Lord. And I'm not going to teach it perfectly, Lord. And there's all kinds of things that could be said differently. But I think this is kind of the heart of the letter and the heart of what you are saying, God, is that we are to bring all things underneath your lordship. They belong to you. We don't ever say, that's mine, God, unless you've given it. And so help us to understand that, Father, and help us to, if nothing else, just have the faith to believe you, even if we don't understand all these things, Lord, but just the faith to believe that your word has been given to us out of great love for us, and you care for us, and you love us, and you did create the world a certain way to be glorifying to you and to give us the maximum pleasure, God, as we obey you. So help us in these things, Lord. You pray for all the couples in our church and just for your blessing to be on them, God, for your joy to be in them, that nothing would take away that joy, Lord, that we would be an honest bunch, that we would be eager to turn and repent and eager to follow you in every way, Lord. Increase our joy always. In your name we pray. Amen. Let's stand up for one more song.